Welcome to the online ministry of Pacific Beach United Methodist Church, located in beautiful San Diego, California. Pacific Beach UMC is a member of the Reconciling Ministries Network and welcomes persons of all ages and backgrounds for worship, study, and service opportunities. More information can be found on our website at pbumc.org. May you be enriched in the hearing of these words, and may you receive and enjoy God's blessing.
I've said before, but I think it's important to continue to be authentic and clear that this series is not entirely my own work, but is inspired by a book that I've been reading. This is by Marcus Borg. It's called Reading the Bible Again for the First Time. I don't know if you've ever had the experience where you've had the chance to sort of see something with fresh eyes. That's the point of the title. To see something with fresh eyes is to see it again, but to really see it for the first time. So that's the title of this book. The subtitle is Taking the Bible Seriously, but Not Literally. And I understand that for many of us, especially if we've been raised in the church, we struggle a little bit with questions about literalism in these ancient texts. And I want to assure you in this way. Whether we identify ourselves as theologically progressive, or if we identify ourselves as theologically sort of centrist or theologically conservative, all of us, no matter what, pick and we choose which sections to place more priority on and which sections to take a bit more literally. Let me give you an example. If you take the Bible literally, then obviously you've never had a bacon cheeseburger in your life. Nor would you possibly wear clothing of mixed fabric, or if you're a man, shave your face or certain parts of your face. I don't see any head coverings of the women in church, right? So all of us already are making some choices. And really, the difference between those who name themselves theologically progressive or centrist or conservative, it's not that one group or another doesn't make choices, it's simply that we make different choices. Can we agree on that? I think that makes sense. Good. Now, one more word on that. That doesn't mean that there's any one group that's any more or less faithful than the other. It means that we make different choices. I think that's important to note as well. Let's talk a little bit just about what we have explored so far in this series. And we started out a couple of weeks ago talking about the Bible as sacrament. The Bible as the lens through which we may experience the living, breathing, active, present God. And we talked about how really we believe in God even more than we believe in the sacred writings here. That doesn't mean that these are unimportant. In fact, I would say these words, these ancient words, these sacred writings are critical for us to experience the living God. But it's God that we believe in, even over the importance of this sacred text. To be Christian, this is a quote from Borg's book, to be Christian is to live within the Christian tradition as a sacrament and let it do its transforming work within and among us. Then last week we talked about the creation stories, and in the midst of some of those creation stories and science versus sacred text and how does that all shake out, part of what we talked about is, listen, if we look at the creation story as one single moment of history, then we miss something. See, if we look at the creation story as one point in history, then it can have a tendency to tell us that God's work is done, that God is no longer creating, that God is no longer speaking. But if we look at the creation stories with the idea that God is the source of everything that is in every moment of time, then we can affirm a God who continues to create. We affirm a God who continues to speak. We affirm a God who continues to give life. And in that, God's creation and creativity continue to invite relationship and connection and care, and are grounded in the sacred. So now we transition from the creation stories into the Hebrew Bible. Now I said last week, and I'll say again, that In seminary, I started calling what many Christians call the Old Testament, I started calling it the Hebrew Bible. Most academics call it the Hebrew Bible, but really just by changing some language a little bit, it's a bit of an act of care. You see, if we tell our Jewish friends that their testament is the old, outdated one, and we're going to prioritize the new one, then, you know, that's not really an expression of love and care to our Jewish friends. So simply by naming this as the Hebrew Bible, I'm not trying to, you know, in fact, I'm trying not to be negative towards folks. So that's, I'm going to try to do better about naming this the Hebrew Bible from now on. But what does the Hebrew Bible contain? Like, what are the sections of the Hebrew Bible? And really, there's three primary sections, okay? Three sections that we can understand. And the first is the Pentateuch, the Torah. Pent means five. So the first five books of what we identify in our Bibles, okay? And so that's Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And really, what that spans is the early creation stories. Last week, I named them as sort of the prehistory that gets us up to Abraham and Sarah. And then from Abraham and Sarah all the way through, you know, Joseph and his siblings, the Exodus story and the Red Sea and the wandering in the wilderness. And at the end of Deuteronomy, it's like all the people are just about to, like, it's their foot's in the air, just about to cross over into the promised land. Like, that's how it ends at the end of Deuteronomy, with the death of Moses. Okay? So that's the Pentateuch, that's the Torah. Okay? After that are the writings of the prophets. And the prophets are divided academically into what's known as the major prophets and the minor prophets. Okay? Now, that's not a moniker about importance, that's a moniker of verbosity. Right? How much they wrote or spoke, right? So the major prophets, that's Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings. You notice it's not 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings. In the Hebrew Bible, especially our Jewish friends, it's Samuel and it's Kings, right? Our Bible has them separate, but it's Samuel and the Kings. Okay, Lamentations, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, those are the major prophets, and those books are just longer, and then the minor prophets are just the ones that are shorter. That's the only delineation. That's the only reason there's major and minor. It's similar, I don't know if you've heard me say this before, but it's similar to the books that are written from the letters from Paul, okay? Right? 1 and 2 Corinthians, Rome, you know, all those letters. They're in the order they are, just longest to shortest, right? Similar methodology, major prophets and minor prophets, okay? So those are the first two sections, the Pentateuch, the Torah, and then the prophets, and then after that are the wisdom writings, okay? So we're talking about the Psalms, Proverbs, Job, Song of Songs, Ruth, Ecclesiastes, Esther, Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Chronicles. Right? Are you impressed that I had all that memorized? Good. It's on that screen right back there. It's not that important. Okay, good. All right, so that's the structure of the Hebrew Bible. And we're already academic. Any questions about that before we move on? Okay, good. It's my hope, there's a lot of information that I'm trying to share with you, but it's my hope that we can move through in ways that are accessible, because I think this is important for us to know. Now, the Pentateuch, part of what I think is important about the Pentateuch is this idea, this overarching theme, right? When you hear me say Pentateuch and Torah, for me, they're synonyms. I'm saying the same thing. Okay, all right. The overarching theme of the Pentateuch is promise and fulfillment. Like, throughout the stories, what we see is promise and fulfillment. And then there are some things that threaten that promise and its fulfillment. Okay? There are different stories about things that get in the way. Okay? But at its core, it's promise and fulfillment. And the promise is the land of Canaan and lots of descendants, right? When we think about sort of the middle of Genesis and Abraham and Sarah, okay, and what is it that Father Abraham, right, we sang the song in Sunday school, what is it that Father Abraham has promised? He's promised a land, a place to call home, a place to be, and he's promised descendants. I was having a conversation with a couple of dads, one of whom is the father of someone who's like just on the edge of, you know, greatness in terms of musical circles, and yet he's an amazing musician himself, and yet what we talked about, what we all agreed on is, as parents, what we want is for our kids to be better than us. Like, that's how I think of myself as a parent. If I can guide my children in such a way that they don't make the same mistakes I did, but instead make whole new mistakes, but turn out better than me. Like, that's my goal as a parent. And I sort of feel like that's what we want. You know, for those of us who, for whom children are the right thing, what we want is we want for the world to end up better and for our children to help make the world better, right? We want to raise kids that are better than us. So when it comes to Abraham and Sarah, when it comes to that promise, right, a place to call home and descendants, that's the core of the promise that I read throughout the Torah, throughout the Pentateuch. Now, I mentioned there are threats to that promise. And one of the primary threats, particularly near the end of Genesis, the middle to the end of Genesis, has to do with what's described as the barrenness of the matriarchs. Now, this comes out of patriarchy, right? And the idea that women are primarily valued for what kind of children they can have. They can have male children, they have more value than if they have female children or no children, right? But constantly, one of the threats in Genesis to the land of Canaan and then descendants, particularly descendants, one of those threats is the barrenness of the matriarch. And it starts with Sarah, right? Sarah with Abraham isn't able to have children for a long time. Then she does, right? But it continues. Rebecca with Isaac. Rebecca isn't able to have children for a while. It continues again. Rachel with Jacob. So there is this threat to God's promise. But what is it that can be read as the book of Genesis continues? When the promises of God seem unachievable, God finds a way to fulfill God's promises. Now, some people would read those texts to say that God made these women unable to have children. I particularly am not willing to say that, but I'm willing to acknowledge that in that circumstance, God finds a way. God finds a way to fulfill God's promise. Well, then we get into the story of Joseph and his amazing Technicolor dream coat. A friend of mine gave me a gift. I've since given it to my son, Cameron. It's this flannel that has all these colors on it, and she gave it to me because I was at a camp and I was telling the story of Joe and his multicolored reversible flannel, right? You might know that the stories are connected. But this story that's familiar to us, it's in pop culture. It's this story about Joseph and his brothers. And they decide, because they're unhappy with the way he interacts with them, they decide that they want to kill him. Now, they have second thoughts, and so instead, they toss him in a ditch and then sell him into slavery, which obviously is much better. Joseph's journey goes through being accused of being inappropriate with somebody's spouse. It ends up with him in jail, but then it ends up with Joseph before the Pharaoh, because he's sent to Egypt. He ends up in front of Pharaoh, and even an assistant, an aide to the Pharaoh, a trusted, what's the word I'm looking for? A compatriot isn't quite the right word, but a trusted advisor, that's the word I'm looking for. A trusted advisor who ends up being a part of the solution to an environmental famine that takes place. And so this is Joseph's journey, but really part of what makes that journey something that we can connect with is, you know, for the most part, we've experienced some kind of personal betrayal. Now, maybe it hasn't been as dramatic as somebody wants to kill us and instead they throw us in a ditch and sell us into slavery. But maybe we have experienced some kind of personal betrayal. But what is it that we might connect with in that story in addition to that idea of personal betrayal, that experience of personal betrayal? That even in the face of that intimate betrayal, God can use those circumstances for God's good purpose. I'm not saying that God made Joseph's brothers do what they did. I'm saying that God can use even that circumstance for God's good purpose. Now, the way that story shakes out is that Joseph remains in power and his family all moves there, and so there's this population of Hebrew people in Egypt. But then as time goes by, those people sort of are reduced in power even as they grow in number, and then eventually there's a new Pharaoh who has no memory of Joseph in the Hebrew people. And so the Hebrew people become enslaved, even to the point that the Pharaoh, fearing the growing number of Hebrew people, says, young Hebrew male children will no longer be allowed to live. And it is this that sets the stage for the birth of Moses. And we're going to hear about that story in a moment. I want you to know that the reason I picked this story is because tradition says that Moses is the author of all five books in the Pentateuch, all five books in the Torah. Now, academics don't agree with that. I'm not interested in getting into that conversation today. I am interested in why the Hebrew people tell these stories and how they continue to have value for us today. And so we'll hear, as we continue this story, the story of the birth of Moses.
Exodus chapter 2, verses 1 through 10. Now a man from Levi's household married a Levite woman. The woman became pregnant and gave birth to a son. She saw that the baby was healthy and beautiful, so she hid him for 3 months. When she couldn't hide him any longer, she took a reed basket and sealed it up with black tar. She put the child in the basket and set the basket among the reeds at the riverbank. The baby's older sister stood watch nearby to see what would happen to him. Pharaoh's daughter came down to bathe in the river while her woman servants walked along beside the river. She saw the basket among the reeds, and she sent one of her servants to bring it in. When she opened it, she saw the child. The boy was crying, and she felt sorry for him. She said, "This must be one of the Hebrews' children." Then the baby's sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Would you like me to go and find one of the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you?" Pharaoh's daughter agreed, "Yes, do that." So the girl went and called the child's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child and nurse it for me, and I'll pay you for your work." So the woman took the child and nursed it. After the child had grown up, she brought him back to Pharaoh's daughter, who adopted him as her son. She named him Moses because, she said, "I pulled him out of the water."
This begins the Exodus story, a fantastic story that maybe you know through Hollywood's version of the Ten Commandments. It's a story that amazes and astounds. But it's a story also that might be identified as Israel's most important story, with Israel's most important prophet. Moses is this towering figure who is negotiator with Pharaoh. He is the leader of the Hebrew people. He is the mediator with God. He is the giver of the law. And if you affirm the tradition that Moses wrote all these five books, then he can be named author as well. But Moses also, in his mediation and his conversations with God, post-Exodus, also is the bringer not only of the law, but of a new covenant. Exodus 19 reads this way, "You saw what I did to the Egyptians and how I lifted you up on eagle's wings and brought you to me. So now, if you faithfully obey me and stay true to my covenant, you will be my most precious possession out of all the peoples, since the whole earth belongs to me. You will be a kingdom of priests for me and a holy nation." This covenant that really is an affirmation of God's covenant with Abraham. This covenant, "I will be your God and you will be my people." Moses, as this central figure, continues to bring this idea of relationship, of covenant with God. But another threat to God's covenant emerges. And this covenant, or this threat, is a threat from within. You see, it's Israel's infidelity. I would say Israel's fear. Right? Israel's fear about what will happen next. If I don't hear God's voice for myself right away, I'm going to build a way for me to experience the divine. I'm thinking about the golden calf. About being so self-centered about I need to have everything and I need and I need to have it now and I need to hoard it for myself and I need to gather up more than I need. I'm thinking about the manna, the bread in the wilderness. I'm so focused on myself in terms of what I'm afraid of that I can't even look skyward. I can't even look heavenward. I can only look around at the next thing that's going to attack me and bite me. I'm thinking about the serpents and eventually the staff with a bronze snake on it. See, throughout this journey, post-Exodus, the biggest threat to God's covenant is the Israeli people themselves. And I wonder, it's not quite written this way in the text, but I wonder if the reason that the Hebrew people are so lost in the wilderness is because they can't get themselves to have faith and trust in the God who just brought them out of Egypt. So after 40 years in the wilderness, Moses has brought law, including the Ten Commandments, but really all of the laws. And if we read through books like Leviticus and Numbers, we see law interspersed with a bit of storytelling. And we understand maybe some ways that it might be most appropriate to treat one another, the ways that we might be reminded of our own history and how it informs the way that we treat others. It might remind us of the importance of loving our neighbor. There are other things in there, too, about don't eat bacon cheeseburgers. Not phrased quite that way, right? But how to take care of yourselves physically and don't eat things that in such a time and such a place didn't have the means of protecting yourself, of maintaining and purifying those foods in such a way that they could, you know, be nourishing and healthy for you, and so don't eat those. Right? Ways to treat the land upon which you depend for sustenance. Okay, those laws. And then, of course, Deuteronomy is the last book in the Pentateuch, and Deuteronomy means the second law, but it's really, in some ways, a rehashing of former law, in some ways, a few new things. But it's Moses saying, listen, I've had this conversation with God, and before you cross into Canaan, I want to share with you these last bit of things, these new laws, these new ideas, this second law. And then Deuteronomy, I think it's chapter 34, ends with the death of Moses. And there we have the Pentateuch. I would also say that this Torah, this idea of all of this, this overarching story of promise and fulfillment, is Israel's identity story. And theologian Walt Brueggemann writes it in this way. He says, it is that most simple, elemental, and non-negotiable storyline which lies at the heart of biblical faith. It is an affirmation in story form which asserts, this is the most important story we know, and we have come to believe it is decisively about us. But I would also say that the Pentateuch is a story of protest. I would even say it's a story of radical protest that requires social justice. And let me say what I mean by that. You see, the oppression under which the Hebrew people went in Egypt was economic exploitation. It was political oppression, and it was religious legitimization. Right? Economic exploitation in terms of being enslaved to do work for which people were not paid. Political oppression in terms of the Egyptian people having more social influence and power than Hebrew people. And religious legitimization in terms of the Pharaoh being a divine kind of Egyptian leader, as the tradition tells, instead of the God of the Hebrews. And so what does the story of the Pentateuch tell us? This overarching story, not only of promise and fulfillment, but also a story of radical protest, but also a new way to be. A way to be about freedom, a way to be about social justice, and a way to be about shalom. Shalom not just being peace, but about well-being and wholeness. Borg writes this, the Exodus story is not about social justice without God, and equally it is not about God without social justice. And Borg suggests, and I feel like it's the same way, that the prophets continue this story. Now, very often when we think about the writings of the prophets, we think about, you know, these people who sat down with their pen and parchment and wrote down all these prophetic things, but we may do well to remember that really, however these things got written, the prophets were profound oral communicators who would stand in city squares or wherever they would stand and offer these compelling arguments. And often these compelling arguments took on this form, as Borg writes, the indictment threat form. And it starts with the indictment or an accusation. It continues with a threat, like what will happen as a result. And then it has a summons. It names the offenders. And sometimes there are some differing orders, but I want to give you an example of what these can look like. And this is out of Micah 3 and Amos 4. This first one from Micah goes like this. This is the summons to the accused. Hear this, you rulers of the house of Jacob and chiefs of the house of Israel. Then comes the indictment. You abhor justice and pervert all equity. You build Zion with blood and Jerusalem with wrong. Its rulers give judgment for a bribe. Its priests teach for a price. Its prophets give oracles for money. Yet they lean upon the Lord and say, surely the Lord is with us. No harm shall come upon us. And then finally the threat. Therefore, because of you, Zion shall be plowed as a field. Jerusalem shall become a heap of ruins and the mountains of the house a wooded height. Do you see how it follows this form? Hear this one from the book of Amos. First, the summons to the accused. Hear this word, you cows of Bashan who are on Mount Samaria. I don't think enough of us call people cows of Bashan, and I wonder if that should come back. Maybe not. But that's the summons. And then it goes to the indictment. You oppress the poor. You crush the needy. You say to your husbands, bring something to drink. And then the threat. The Lord God has sworn by his holiness, the time is surely coming upon you when they shall take you away with hooks, even the last of you with fish hooks. Through breaches in the wall you shall leave, each one straight ahead. Do you see how it follows this criticism, this indictment threat form? And when we read the prophets, we see this form repeated over and over and over again. But you see, the prophets are not just about these criticisms, they're also about activity. The prophets are about prophetic criticism, but also prophetic energizing, compelling, the speaking out. See, what is it that the prophets were critiquing? So often, we're speaking out for social justice. For people who may have been conquered and taken to a new place. I'm thinking about the Babylonian exile. For people who within their own communities were messing things up and they had the opportunity to do something different. And these prophets were speaking out for social justice. And one of the things that Borg writes that was sort of a paradigm shift for him is that he came to understand in a new way that these prophets weren't just saying whatever came to mind because they felt like saying it, but because they felt compelled to say what they said because of a profound and prophetic experience of God. Do you see why over the course of this series I keep talking about how important it is for us to have an experience of God? We must have a spiritual experience if we are to be empowered and enabled to do the kind of good social justice work that these prophets proclaim. Prophetic criticizing and prophetic energizing. The prophets wrote as a response to profound and personal experiences of God. And then finally, and it's my last slide, the wisdom writings, which don't necessarily claim to be a revealed truth, but instead are grounded in an observation of and reflection upon human experience. Consider the book of Ecclesiastes. Consider the book of Proverbs. Continue even the book of Job, which we've explored recently. And consider reading these texts as texts that are grounded in the observation of and reflection upon the human experience. And how we can see deeply personal, intimate confessions and writings and wisdom. My friends, what I see overarching in all of these texts is the idea that God continues to desire to be in covenant with us. That God continues to promise to us a place that we can feel like we can be ourselves, a place that we can call home. That God continues to promise to us a way that we can live into perhaps making the world a better place, whether that's nurturing our own children or nurturing the children of the community around us. So that as the world moves forward, through our transformation and what we might guide others into an experience of faith might be a transformation for them so that the world even incrementally gets better. So that the world changes. Why? Because God still speaks. Because God still acts. Because through this lens we might still have an experience of God. It is my hope, it is my prayer that we continue to seek this experience of God and be transformed. Amen. Friends, let's enter into a time of prayer. Holy God, indeed you are the air that we breathe. Your presence surrounds us, intimately close and exponentially far away. Indeed, God, you fill all the space in between. With your light, with your love, with your compassion, with your strength, and with your hope. As we continue to explore these sacred texts, help us through study, through reading, through conversation, to have a renewed experience of you, to live into the spirituality into which you call us. As a part of this community of faith, we offer ourselves in support and love and playfulness and laughter and a care and support of one another. God, we lift up this prayer and any prayer in our faith community that goes unsaid as we join together in the Lord's Prayer as we say together, Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen.